Welcome to the Dungeons & Dragons podcast. I'm your host, Rodney Thompson, and with me today are Peter Lee.
Hello.
And Chris Dupuy.
How come I didn't get to be the host?
Because I'm the host. Today we'll be talking about Origins and Scoundrels of Skullport, so let's talk about some games. So, recently, Peter and I went to the Origins convention in Columbus, Ohio, one of my personal favorite gaming conventions. Pete, was that your... No, that was not your first time at Origins,
right?
No,
it was my third time there.
Really? Okay, so you went last year, right?
Went last year.
Now, did you ever go before you came to Wizards of the Coast?
I came once as a judge for D&D Miniatures back in 2005 or so.
Back in the dark ages of 2005?
Yes, okay. Yes.
Now, Chris, did you go to Origins last year, is that right?
Yeah, I went with Pete last year.
Yep. Cool. All right, so we've all been to the convention. It's one of my favorites. I actually really love Origins because when I was freelancing, it was a great place to go and actually, you know, meet some of the people I'd be working with. And now I love it because it's a great con to go and play games at. I know that even this year with us going there and being as busy as we were, I actually got a fair bit of gaming time in this time.
Mm-hmm. So did I.
Yeah, it was really great. They've done an awesome job of keeping the convention going. Columbus is a great town, but the big reason that I think we were there was mostly to show off the hot off the presses production copy of Scoundrels of Skullport.
That's correct.
It's the first big expansion for Lords of Waterdeep, mm-hmm. and Pete and I basically spent our entire 3-4 days at the convention carrying around a copy of the expansion and seeing who would notice.
Yep.
It was not extremely structured.
No. It was a lot of fun. We'd walk into an elevator and people would see us carrying this and they'd be, oh, is that out yet? You know, it's not out till August. Oh, how did you get it? We're one of the designers. Oh, that's awesome. I love that game. You know, and it was really exciting to see how people were happy with Waterdeep and that an expansion was coming.
Yeah, I was actually really surprised. I don't think it's exaggerating to say that we did not make it from our room to anywhere we were going carrying the box without at least one person stopping us to comment on it.
Yep.
A lot of great response to Waterdeep at the convention, and of course, we were sort of being a little sneaky because we were carrying around Scoundrels of Skullport under our arm. And or you know whoever's carrying the box, and not really you know advertising. Hey, we brought this here, but a surprising number of people would sort of do the double take,
yeah.
Right? And like, oh, that guy's got Waterdeep. Wait a minute, that's not just Waterdeep. But that was actually it was really great just to get the you know. People at the convention stopping us and flagging us down and saying, you know, hey, we really like the game and are excited about the expansion. So I think if nothing else, I enjoyed going to the convention to spend some time with the people that actually play the games that we design. And that's always one of my favorite parts of any convention, really.
Yeah, I agree. That's really the exciting part about going to a new convention is it's always good to show off the new and exciting stuff that you have to reveal, but it's really, really a lot of fun to sit down and play with the fans with product that is not only exciting, but they really enjoy playing it, and just getting to sit down and play with them is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I know, and Peter, you can probably agree with me here, but I have not yet grown tired of playing Lords of Waterdeep, which is occasionally miraculous for something that, you know, we've played this much, right? I can't think of another board game I've played more than Waterdeep, but the best part about the convention was playing the game with people I don't play with all the time, playing the game with people that had just bought the game in the store or played at their local game store, because it's so nice to meet other people that are just enjoying the game and actually get to play with them, right? I mean, that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who, for them, it's their first time seeing it. We've been playing it for maybe a year and a half in some cases. So it's great to see, you know, new eyes looking at the game and seeing the wonder that they have with the things that are coming out.
Yeah, one of my favorite moments from the show was we were walking through the hotel bar and restaurant area, and I think I was carrying the box, the expansion box, up to my hotel room, and from basically 200 feet away, someone basically screams, "Oh my gosh, is that the new expansion?" And it comes running across the bar, and it was pretty awesome to get that kind of excitement out of somebody. Yep. Because I mean, it's really easy. when you work on something day in and day out to forget that for a lot of people who aren't exposed to it constantly, it is this sort of new and exciting thing. But, you know, for the three of us especially, we have been done working on this product for, you know, almost a year, basically, by the time it gets out into stores, just because of the nature of production times.
Yeah.
But yeah, we played a lot of games at the con. We played the base game and the expansion at the show a lot. Mm-hmm. We had some seminars that went really well, very well attended. I was super pleased with all the people that came out. So if anyone's listening that came to either of our two seminars, I want to thank you personally, because that was really great to get a chance to interact with you in that kind of environment. Pete can attest that.
Yep.
That seminar attendance at Origins is not always super high, just because Origins is a great con to play games at, and people are usually busy actually playing games.
Yep.
So getting the turnout we did, we were very, very happy. So thank you to everyone that came to that. And I think perhaps it's obvious to say, but the highlight of the show for me was the Origins Awards.
Yeah.
Lords of Waterdeep was nominated for Best Board Game in the Origins Award, and we won.
Yep. Yay.
Yay.
I had butterflies in my stomach the whole morning. I'm like, oh, I hope I get it. I hope we win.
Pete was kind of a nervous wreck, actually, all day. he was something of a disaster.
Yeah.
Pete, keep it together, man.
No.
But we took home the Best Board Game Origins Award, which is actually my first Origins Award for game design.
And that's actually a streak for us, right?
It's a streak for Peter Lee, especially.
Yeah, that is my third Origins Award for board games in a row.
Yes, and so Pete completes the hat trick.
That's pretty awesome.
What were the previous two?
Last year was Conquest of N'Rath, and the year before was Castle Ravenloft.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Well, I just want to say, again, thank you to everyone who voted for the game. Thank you for the folks at Gamma and Origins who made the convention so welcoming and who made the Origins Awards so great. I know I'm extremely honored to have won the award and on behalf of everyone who worked on the game, because as I got to say at the awards, it wasn't just, you know, Pete and I working on the game. There were developers and art directors and a lot of people who put a lot of hard work into the game. I want to thank all of them and then thank, you know, everyone that was responsible for helping us win the award, because it is truly a great honor to win.
Yep.
So as we mentioned earlier, the main reason we were at Origins was to show off Scoundrels of Skullport, which, if you haven't heard yet, is the first expansion for Lords of Waterdeep, as I mentioned earlier. And it is something that we've kind of had the first inklings of what we wanted to put in the expansion rattling around in our minds, even as early as the design of the base game. I mean, you can even see there are a few hints in the base Lords of Waterdeep game that we were kind of thinking, hey, you know, if this does well, we might want to expand on this.
We had done some preliminary tests when we were doing development of Lords of Waterdeep to see if it was possible to go to six players. We didn't have the components for it in the base game, but we knew that with, you know, playing these games with an extra board with a couple of new spaces, that you could play the game with six players.
Right. And so that was sort of that's the genesis of Scoundrels of Skullport, was the idea that, you know, well, you know, we think we could take this game up to six players, but we need more to go with it to make that work. So that was really where we got started on the expansion. And then over time, through design and development, it expanded more and more. And now we've got the finished product is actually coming out in August, and it is actually two expansions in one. We call the overall box Scoundrels of Skullport, but inside the box are two smaller expansions, one of which is themed for Skullport, and the other which is themed for Undermountain, both of which are important locations in Waterdeep. You guys listening to this podcast who play board games probably are familiar with this multiple expansions in one box idea. If you've played Pandemic or Alhambra are two examples of other board games that have done this same kind of, you buy one box, but it's got multiple different expansions in it. And I think that the thing that's sort of most exciting to us about that is the, just like anything else in Lords of Waterdeep, we've sort of built it for replayability and making sure that every time we add something to the game, it's contributing to that feeling of excitement of something different every time you play. So, Pete, do you want to talk a little bit about how we went from three expansions down to two? Because I think that was a story that people might be interested to hear.
Sure. So when we first started with the design, we originally thought this would be three little game modules in one. And the original design had asymmetric components where one of the expansions was primarily around buildings, and another one was primarily around entry cards, and the third one was primarily around a new component that was corruption. Now, the corruption one really felt fleshed out because you had new buildings, you had new entry cards, and it just felt really cohesive. But when you looked at the new building expansion and the new entry expansion, they didn't really have any other considerable components. They felt a little flat. They didn't feel like there was enough of a new experience. But when we combined those two expansions, it was at the time it was Luskin and Undermountain. When we combined those two modules into one, it felt right. It felt the two happened to go together really well, and it felt like a complete expansion. And so that is why we went from three to two. The big thing is a lot of the times we don't know when we start where we're going to end up, and that's part of the discovery. And that was one of the things we found out.
Yeah, I think that the Skullport expansion, which, as Pete mentioned, deals a lot with a new mechanic called corruption. And to sketch it out briefly, corruption is a new resource, but it's actually a negative resource in that at the end of the game, if you have any corruption in your tavern, you actually lose points. But any of the action spaces or cards or quests that give you corruption as a result also give you some pretty saucy rewards. But adding a whole new component, adding a whole new resource to the game, sort of necessitated that we integrate it into not only, you know, the entry cards, but also the quests, and also the buildings, and also the expansion board. I mean, there was, in order to integrate a whole new resource, you need to make it a complete experience. And every part of the game needs to touch on this new mechanic, because that's the way it is with all of our other resources. I mean, it's not like you can't get fighters from intrigue cards or something like that. It's always been, you know, from the very beginning, corruption demanded a more cohesive experience. And I think that that was sort of a case of the one mechanic that we really were excited about brought that whole expansion module together, whereas it was sort of the reverse situation like you were talking about with Undermountain, where we had these smaller components, and it wasn't until we combined them that we saw the direction it was heading in.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, I think that was one of those cases where we had two paths to the same location,
yep.
And both of them ended up giving us something really exciting. So we've talked a little bit about the Skullport module, and I know, Chris, you were just flipping through the cards before the podcast here, and I know you were looking at some of the Undermountain cards, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
So why don't you tell people what the Undermountain expansion is all about? We've talked about Skullport being about corruption and a negative resource and adding a little bit more strategy to the game. Why don't you tell people a little bit about what to expect from the Undermountain expansion?
The Undermountain expansion, when I give the elevator pitch to people, is it's all about bigger things, more bigger quest rewards, bigger resources flying around the board, just an all-around larger Waterdeep experience, as opposed to Skullport, where you're getting kind of saucy rewards at the expense of having to either accept the corruption or have to deal it out later and get rid of it. With Undermountain, you're just getting bigger stuff. You're sharing resources all around the board. We're taking resources, and you're getting two clerics by going to a building, but you're also taking a cleric and putting it on an action space. And you can do that really strategically and kind of combo two placements together, so that way you can get your two clerics and then put it on a space that you're immediately going to replace from Waterdeep Harbor. Or you can kind of bait your buildings, put a resource on a building that you want someone else to take, so you'll get the owner's benefit, or maybe keep resources away from a space that you want to take later. There's a lot of tactical and strategic elements to sharing resources in this way, and it allows us to really kick up the rewards that a lot of our quests, buildings, and intrigue cards are giving out. On top of that, we have a couple of cool mechanics on the quest cards, one of which is we have a plot quest cycle in this expansion that works similarly to a plot quest cycle in the main game, where when it's in the main game, when you complete a quest of a certain type, you get extra victory points. Well, this cycle is when you gain a quest of a certain type, you get the associated resource. So when you gain a piety quest, you'll get a cleric. When you gain a commerce quest, you gain gold. And so what this allows you to do when you get this quest completed is it allows you to start snowballing these quest types, because you can just really focus on that avenue, and you don't have to spend two agents to get the quest and get one of the main resources, because it's all tied together. And all of a sudden, gaining quests is a way to get resources. And so that kind of exemplifies the idea of where, you know, we're taking the agent placement and just kicking up the way you can allocate resources out because of that. We've also got some crazy quest cycles. We've got a commerce quest called Threaten the Builders Guild, that the reward is immediately put all face-up buildings in the Builders Hall into play under your control at no cost.
Yes, the Gonzo quest cycle, I believe, is what we called it.
That is what we called it. But these kind of quests are just very, very expensive, and while they may not look that crazy in terms of victory point gain, if you combo it at the right time with the right opportunity, you can just jump across the board.
Yeah, I think Under Mountain is really good at sort of accelerating what we call the engine building aspect of the game, in that we're providing new ways to get the resources you need, to complete the quests you need, that in turn give you rewards that you capitalize on in different ways. And I think that Under Mountain especially is sort of like, okay, you know how to build an engine, you know how to build a car, and that most cars run on gasoline. When you add Under Mountain, this car now runs on dynamite, right? It's just sort of a lot more bigger, unexpected things. Mm-hmm. And I want to actually back up a little bit, because you kind of glossed over a mechanic that I think is really interesting that we see both in Undermountain and in Skullport, and that is the placement mechanic. It's a new mechanic that we've developed for these two expansions, where certain intrigue cards and buildings and quests will tell you to take a resource and place it on an action space on the board. And what that does is the next person to take that action space also takes that resource. So as Chris alluded to earlier, it means that you can make certain spaces more attractive, or in the case of the Skullport expansion, where you're actually placing corruption on the board, you can make certain spaces less attractive. And I actually think that's one of the most interesting mechanics we cooked up for these two expansions, because it's not only, you know, sort of strategic and that you have to think long term, it's also highly interactive. And we always talk about how we wanted Waterdeep from the very beginning to be a very interactive game. We never wanted you to feel like you were just playing solitaire, four player solitaire, right? Mm-hmm. But the placement mechanic, I think, is a way to look at the game from an interactive standpoint and see that the things that I do will affect the things that the other players will do.
Yeah, it really kicks up the idea of alliances too, because, you know, you'll often play the intrigue card that allows you to give a fighter to someone else or give a cleric to someone else, and all of a sudden there's this table talk about, well, you gotta help this guy because he's in front, or I helped you last time. When you've got that wizard that someone desperately needs and you're trying to figure out which building it needs to go on, that it just amplifies that that interaction.
Yeah. Now, Pete, we actually talked about it a little bit at the seminar at Origins, but do you want to tell people about the origin of that that particular mechanic?
Oh yeah, it's been so long.
Yeah, I know, right? Oh, I mean, you know, man. you work on something a year and a half ago, and you forget how everything started. But
yeah, I totally forgot.
So one of the things that Rodney handed over to development was an idea of cooperative buildings, and these were buildings that had two action spaces where you didn't get anything until agents were assigned to each of the squares. And in playtesting, we found that people, as good as they were, people didn't use them, especially newer players. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we tried out was, instead of having the cooperative nature of the space being on the building all by itself, you would place a resource on another action space, so you would in fact turn something else on the board into a de facto cooperation space. And that made it you got the resources immediately, so people were more excited about using it in the first place, and then you could also guide another player's action at the same time, and they were it filled a similar niche in the game, but it was played a lot more, and a mechanic that isn't played is tough to include in the game, so we made the switch, and the game got a lot better.
So, in addition to the two expansions that have all their own mechanics, there are also some things in the box that work for every game you're going to play. There is a, as we mentioned earlier, the ability to have a sixth player in the game. You can add the Gray Hands faction, which is gray-colored agents, to the game, and I think that the six-player portion of the expansion is one of the most frequently requested expansions I see, because I know a lot of people end up having game groups that's like, well, maybe we play D&D most nights and it's a DM and five players, but if we want to play a board game instead, it's tough because there's not a lot of six-player board games out there. So I think we were very sensitive to that fact when we started putting this, even the base game, together. Yeah. And are looking forward to seeing how people enjoy playing with six players, because it does lengthen the game a little bit, but I think that's okay. I mean, yeah, if you're playing with six players, you're accepting that.
One other really exciting thing that I'm really happy that we were able to include is there's an extra agent for each color. So there's actually six gray hand agents, and there's an extra agent, the sixth agent, for each other color. So that way, if you wanted to play what we call the longer game as a two-player game, and you wanted to include some of these extra spaces, it keeps that pressure up in a two-player game. And that's one of really the highlights of Lords of Waterdeep, is that it plays so well across the entire range of players. My wife and I often play the two-player game of Lords of Waterdeep, and it's just as exciting as a five-player game.
Another thing I wanted to mention with regards to the expansion is that in the rule book, we've actually taken some steps to make sure that a lot of the material that was in our frequently asked questions have actually made it into this rule book. So for those picking up this expansion, wanting to make sure you have the most up-to-date rules, this rule book in the Scoundrels of Skullport expansion does have the frequently asked questions that we have on our website, and also some new information that is relevant to the Scoundrels of Skullport expansion itself.
And to go back to your earlier comment about replayability, when you open up this box, one of the greatest things about Waterdeep is the awesome way the tray is laid out. When you open up this box, Skullport has a similar feel to the tray. You take out the cardboard pieces, and it's laid out almost in two, with all of the components that are shared across the two right in the middle, and then it's got trays for the intrigue cards, the quests, the buildings, and the lords for each expansion on either side. And so when you crack open Skullport and you're going to add it into your Lords of Waterdeep game, it's easy to just pick a side. We're going to play Skullport, we're going to play Endermountain, and shuffle the cards together and you play. But we also introduced a way to mix the two together, which creates a crazy experience. Because once you've played Skullport and you've played Endermountain and you've gotten a feel for how those games play and you're used to you know, certain quests coming out and you know you're looking for that one corruption quest that allows you to get rid of the three corruption because you need that one. When you put both of them together and you use both modules in a game, it is a really exciting experience because not only do you have both expansion boards out, you're playing with corruption, you're playing with resources being shared around the board. You know, you're playing unexpected success from Undermountain, where you draw two intrigue cards and you can play them immediately, where you have all this crazy excitement from the expansions, but you're also playing them with half of the base game components.
That's right.
So the quests that you've come to know and love, the Magister's Orb, just might not come out this game. Griffin Cavalry, you never know. And it creates this kind of hectic game experience that just feels so fresh and so new because you're so used to the components from the base game and you have no idea what's coming out in the game with two modules.
Yeah, I think that me personally, when I play the game, I tend to like playing not only the longer version of the game, but also I think I like mixing the two expansions a lot, personally.
When we finally, after, when Pete and I were working on development and we finally had, we had everything all set up and everything was clicking, it was working just right, and we said, all right, let's finally see how this works, and we put it together and we started playing and oh my god, it was so much fun.
I can't wait to see what happens when people out in the wilds of the world of board gaming start playing with both expansions, because I just know that no matter how much we think we know what to expect from that, there's going to be crazy things that happen that will surprise and delight people. So yes. I'm always excited to see one of my games get out there for people to play, but I'm particularly excited about this one because I think we've taken the Lords of Waterdeep formula, which people seem to really, really like, if Origins is any indication. And we've kind of turned it up to 11 in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And also then we threw dynamite in it.
Because so, why not?
Right, because why not? That's what you do when you're a game designer. You throw dynamite at things. Yeah. But yeah, I'm really excited about this expansion. The expansion comes out in August, which seems really far away right now, but I'm sure we'll be here before we know it. Mm-hmm. So I'm jazzed for people to get to play and hope that while I'm at Gen Con this year, I will get a chance to play Skullport with some more people. So since Mike and Jeremy have foolishly left me in charge of the podcast, I've decided to hijack the last 5 or 10 minutes of the podcast to talk about my campaign. Because Chris and Pete, both here, are players in my Tuesday night campaign, this is a good opportunity for us to tell people a little bit about what we personally are doing with D&D Next. For a little setup, just so everyone knows, on Tuesday nights, I run a campaign for folks that work here in the Wizards of the Coast offices set in the world of Greyhawk. I'm running what I call the Gospel According to Gary, so only things written by Gary Gygax are canon up to this point. But Pete and Chris are both players in this campaign, and I originally started it as a playtest because, you know, we need to test D&D Next in not only the sort of fast-paced stress-testing environment that we test in here at the office, but also in the more traditional adventure and campaign playtesting that, you know, is more like how people use it out in the wilds. Also, it's a really convenient excuse to convince my fiance that I need to have another night of gaming. But
because he didn't have enough of those already.
Right. Yes, I'm so deprived. But anyways, I don't want to go into too much detail about the events of the campaign because otherwise I would be spending the next hour talking about that. But I would like to ask you guys some questions about your experiences in the game so far. And now, Pete, we always identify Pete as a Watcher player.
Yep, that's correct.
And the Watcher archetype is the person who sort of sits back and observes the game and participates at leisure. Now, you self-identify as a Watcher, right?
Yeah, I definitely do.
Can you tell people why you think you play like that?
Some of it is, you know, you come into Wizard of the Coast, and these are these fantastically famous game designers, and you're like, what sort of role player are you to be hanging around with these guys? I mean, I've been here for 5 years, and I still am awed by the abilities of Mike to oh spout Shakespearean gibberish throughout a campaign right off the top of his head, and I don't understand how he can even do that. And
what I love, by the way, is that you are three-time Origins Award-winning game designer Peter Lee, intimidated by other game designers at Wizards.
That's true.
But you're a Watcher character, yep. and Pete, tell me about your character.
Right now, I'm playing a rogue, a human rogue, and typically I like one part of my character that is very straight down. Right down the fairway, something that is very typical. But then I usually like some sort of twist. And the way that I got the twist in this character was through backgrounds. And my rogue is a sage in this case. So that little decision on being a sage, and more precisely to be a master of forbidden lore, gave the character a very Cthulhu-esque feel to him. So I used to play a ton of Call of Cthulhu, so I'm used to playing characters that fighting is not always the primarily thing to do. And in fact, if you fight, you typically go crazy and die. So my character is definitely not someone you would associate as being a fighter, but someone that is more of an investigator.
Yeah, I think we usually describe him as he's sort of like the wormy guy from The Mummy, right?
Yeah,
the sort of skeezy, creepy paranoid guy. Yeah. And I think creepy paranoid are probably like the two best adjectives to ascribe to Walrein.
That's definitely true.
Yeah.
That's definitely true.
Now, Chris, you're actually, are you the newest Wizards of the Coast employee at my table, aren't you?
That is true.
Wow, so you're the rookie.
I am.
And we treat you like
and
one.
And it shows.
So, rookie, why don't you tell folks about your character in my campaign?
So, my character, Slaren, is a high elf ranger.
Started out as a fighter because we didn't have the ranger designed yet.
That's right. He started out as an archer fighter. And then finally, when the ranger class was available, I was able to upgrade him, which is great because now I can track, which we are in the middle of. Our
yes.
cliffhanger last week was me... Slaren tracking the big bad who had just gone invisible in a muddy battlefield.
That's
and
right.
We were about to run off to chase him down.
Yes. I would like to point out that I feel like Slaren has been kind of a rock star in this current adventure because we've been making really heavy use of the exploration rules, which means that since the ranger is quite good at exploring and overland travel, I feel like you have definitely, even though you might have missed a few sessions, have been kind of a superstar this adventure.
Oh, it's a lot better than my experience in the combat section where I, you know, just randomly kill townsfolk because...
I don't know if it was random.
Yeah, well, he was shooting at me.
I'm pretty sure it was quite deliberate.
Yeah. I would also like to point out that in this last session, you had the magic bullet and you used it.
What was it? That was a two, wasn't it?
That was a two.
That
yes.
was a two, yes.
So the story I'm alluding to here is Chris, his character, came into possession of an arrow of slaying that was given to him by their patron to use to assassinate his rival. Unfortunately, due to the chaos that is my campaign, their patron was then killed by another player character. And so, Chris, you found yourself walking around with a random arrow of slaying that you'd been sort of quietly saving for...
It took me all of three nights to bring it back out.
No, I think it's been four sessions since. But I mean, you know, you're like, oh yeah, okay, I'm gonna keep this thing and put it in my backpack, and you haven't really talked about it, and then you brought it out, and what happened?
Yeah, it was awesome because the big bad, which we are now chasing, spoiler alert, it didn't work. he's tearing through us, and he's got this cloak on him that's deflecting our attacks.
Oh, you mean the Living Shadow cloak?
Yes, that one.
His familiar?
Yes. And he's got all these minions that are attacking all the army, that are attacking the soldiers we're with. And in the middle of this melee, I'm thrown back by a thunder wave, and I pull the arrow out, and I say, Lord Rickard says hello. And I loose my arrow...
Two.
And roll a two.
And it goes sailing off into the night.
And it was this...
Into the dark, muddy night.
I'm gonna look for it. It's totally gone, though.
Well, now you have to decide if you want to actually continue to track and pursue the bad guy or go find that arrow of slaying.
Yeah.
Don't worry. There'll be some ally guard off in the distance with an arrow of slaying sticking him. It's all Slayerin's fault.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I'm really enjoying the campaign, and I think that, you know, if playtesting is work, this is the most fun I have working pretty much every week.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is something I look forward to every other week. I am sad on the weeks that we don't play.
Yeah. Well, that about wraps it up for this episode of the D&D Podcast. I'd like to thank all of you for listening. If you enjoyed the show or want to send us some of your feedback, you can email us at dndinsider@wizards.com, or you can check out the D&D Next playtest on dndnext.com. On behalf of Peter Lee and Chris Dupuy, I'm Rodney Thompson, and thanks for listening.